Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy. Soren Kierkegaard, narrated by Charlton Heston. Part 7.
Clearly, Socrates and Jesus represent two very different types of teachers. Socrates coaxes the truth from the learner. Jesus is the truth. Jesus himself, rather than some doctrine he conveys, redeems the believer from error. Each of these ways of teaching corresponds to a kind of religious experience. Socrates, believing that the truth is within every person, stands for the religious perspective that God is within you. You only have to look deeply enough to find him. Climacus calls this religiousness A. He labels as religiousness B the belief that Jesus, as God in history, is the truth that comes to man, to human beings who exist in a state of error so complete they can't even recognize their condition as error. Although there are many contrasts between these two types of religious existence, no difference is more dramatic than their valuation of time. For the believer in religiousness A, for the person who believes eternal truth is within each of us, nothing essential is decided in time. Johannes Climacus says that believers in religiousness A view existence with humor. Their forbearance and detached attitude comes with knowing that nothing is really at stake.
The difference between a religious man and a man who does not transform his existence religiously thus becomes a humorous distinction. That whereas the religious man employs his whole life in becoming sensible of a relation to eternal blessedness, and the other does not trouble himself about it, they both of them, eternally viewed, get equally far along.
In contrast, religiousness B, the Christian religion, asserts that we lost our relationship to God in time through sin. We must reestablish that relation or else forfeit our happiness forever. The moment of decision between faith and offense has an infinite consequence.
A moment such as this is unique. To be sure, it is short and temporal, as the moment is. It is passing, as the moment is past. As the moment is in the next moment. And yet, it is decisive. And yet, it is filled with the eternal. A moment such as this must have a special name. Let us call it the fullness of time.
By describing the radical differences between the two types of religion, Climacus is showing that Hegel and his cronies have fundamentally distorted both Christianity and religiousness A. They've run the two together. As he puts it,
if Christianity is possibly wrong, so much at least is certain, that speculative philosophy is definitely wrong.
As its title suggests, the concluding unscientific postscript marks the end of Kierkegaard's pseudonymous authorship. He originally intended the volume to be his final appearance on the Danish literary scene, but his impulse to write quickly got the better of him. So Kierkegaard gave up his rather impractical plans to become a country parson and turned his energies to producing a second body of writings, this one in his own name and overtly Christian. This is not to say he'd published nothing in his own name before the winter of 1846 when he published the postscript. He'd written newspaper articles, a scathing review of a Hans Christian Andersen novel, and a dissertation on Socrates. He also published 18 edifying discourses in his own name, alongside the pseudonymous authorship. When each of the pseudonymous works was published, he arranged for a volume of these short devotional pieces to appear simultaneously. He comments on the relationship of the two.
There was the big work, Either Or, which was much read and more discussed. And then the two edifying discourses, dedicated to my deceased father. No one took serious notice of the two discourses or concerned himself about them. Indeed, I remember even that one of my acquaintances came to me with a complaint that in good faith he had gone and bought the book with the notion that, since it was by me, it must be something witty and clever. I remember, too, that I promised him that if he wished, he should get his money back. I held out Either Or to the world in my left hand, and in my right the two edifying discourses. But all, or as good as all, grasped with the right what I held in my left.
In his literary autobiography entitled The Point of View for My Work as an Author, Kierkegaard contends he was a religious author from the beginning to the end of his literary career. So why did he write the pseudonymous literature in the first place? He answers that he tailored his message to the besetting illusion of the day, the belief that one becomes a Christian simply by being born into Christendom. Most Christians were born into a society where Christianity was the culturally dominant and officially sanctioned religion.
Everyone with some capacity for observation who seriously considers what is called Christendom or the conditions in a so-called Christian country must surely be assailed by profound misgivings. What does it mean that all these thousands and thousands call themselves Christians as a matter of course? These many, many men, of whom the greater part, so far as one can judge, live in categories quite foreign to Christianity.
But how to deal with this illusion? By denunciation? Kierkegaard says such a tactic's completely ineffectual.
If it is an illusion that all are Christians, and if there is anything to be done about it, it must be done indirectly. Not by one who vociferously proclaims himself an extraordinary Christian, but by one who, better instructed, is ready to declare that he is not a Christian.
Instead of a frontal assault, Kierkegaard tries to be indirect, to wound from behind. His strategy is first to reach people where they live by writing about aesthetic matters. Only then does he introduce religious themes.
If then, according to our assumption, the greater number of people in Christendom only imagine themselves to be Christians, in what categories do they live? They live in aesthetic, or at the most, in aesthetic ethical categories. The religious writer must, therefore, first get into touch with men. That is, he must begin with aesthetic achievement. This is earnest money. The more brilliant the achievement, the better for him. If a man lives in this conceit, lives, that is to say, in categories entirely foreign to Christianity, in purely aesthetic categories, and if someone is capable of winning and captivating him with aesthetic works, and then knows how to introduce the religious so promptly that with the momentum of his abandonment to the aesthetic, the man rushes straight into the most decisive definitions of the religious. What then? Why, then he must take notice.
So the pseudonymous works are designed to make readers aware that they're aesthetes, ethicists, even believers in the internal god of religiousness A, but they're not Christians as they believe. Surprisingly, the edifying discourses have much the same purpose. Kierkegaard signed these works with his own name because he endorsed everything they contained, but they didn't express everything he believed about religion. The edifying discourses were limited strictly to the categories of religiousness A, the religion that Climacus associated with Socrates. But the pastors and bishops of Denmark referred to these discourses as sermons, a term Kierkegaard reserves for an address proclaiming paradoxical religion, or religiousness B. To Kierkegaard, the Danish clergy's idea that the edifying works were sermons betrayed their confusions on the subject of Christianity. Climacus goes so far as to say that exposing this confusion was the main point of the edifying discourses. Behind both the pseudonymous literature and the edifying discourses, Kierkegaard's intricate theory of indirect communications at work. Though his accomplishments extraordinary and his theory of communication profound, Kierkegaard became aware that few, if any, had really gotten the point. He responded in part by writing a literary autobiography laying out the plan behind his writing. But he also dropped much of the evasion and subterfuge in his subsequent works. He began to state his views at times with brutal directness. As we'll see, Kierkegaard moved gradually but inexorably towards his final showdown with the Danish Lutheran Church. December 1845 represented a major turning point in Kierkegaard's life and writings. He sent to the printers the final work of his pseudonymous authorship, the concluding unscientific postscript. But without a pause to catch his breath after 4 years of incredible literary exertions, he threw himself into battle with a dangerous and vicious opponent, a Copenhagen scandal rag named the Corsair. The Corsair specialized in satires and exposés of the respected and powerful in Danish society. It quickly grew to have the largest circulation in the country. Ironically, Kierkegaard was one of the rare public figures to receive kind treatment at the hands of the Corsair. It even proclaimed Victor Eremita, the pseudonymous author of Either Or, to be immortal because of his great literary accomplishment. But Kierkegaard regarded the paper's praises as a dubious honor.
I will suppose that there was a city where the prostitutes made a practice of abusing all the decent girls once a week. But there was one young girl who was never abused. On the contrary, she was acclaimed and praised. As young girls do, she would throw herself in tears on her mother's neck and say, "Oh, mother, why can't I be abused too? All my friends look at me suspiciously because I am praised."
The immediate occasion for Kierkegaard's battle with the Corsair was an article that appeared not in the Corsair itself, but in a literary collection authored by P.L. Müller. Müller, who is widely believed to be the model for Johannes the Seducer, published a recreated conversation among several Danish literati. Their critical evaluation of Kierkegaard's pseudonymous works turns quickly into moral criticism of Kierkegaard himself. Emphasizing the recurring tales of unhappy love and broken engagements in those works, one of the speakers reflects,
"If you regard life as a dissecting laboratory and yourself as a cadaver, then go ahead, lacerate yourself as much as you want to. As long as you do not harm anyone else, the police will not disturb your activity. But to spin another creature into your spider web, dissect it alive, or torture the soul out of it drop by means of experimentation, that is not allowed, except with insects. And is there not something horrible and revolting to the healthy human mind even in this idea?"
Kierkegaard immediately responded with an article in the newspaper The Fatherland. He took Müller to task for numerous misreadings and misunderstandings. But the real sting in the article comes at the end, where Kierkegaard says that his wish to be criticized by the Corsair has finally, if indirectly, been fulfilled. He reveals that Müller is the spirit secretly behind the scandal rag. This revelation doomed Müller's hopes of becoming the professor of aesthetics at the University of Copenhagen. It prompted the Corsair to undertake a relentless 2-year campaign to deride Kierkegaard and assassinate his character. These attacks, copiously illustrated with satirical line drawings, are invariably crude and cruel. One noteworthy example depicts Kierkegaard riding on the shoulders of Regine Olsen. It's captioned, "How You Trained Your Girl." Incredibly, though, the main subject of these attacks were Kierkegaard's spindly legs and uneven trousers. His incessant walks through Copenhagen, which previously had been unnoticed, now became the center of attention. The heckling and abuse gradually grew so bad that he couldn't sit in church without being disturbed. Kierkegaard had formerly enjoyed talking with people from all walks of life as he strolled the streets of Copenhagen, but now he was completely isolated. He'd expected to pay a price for taking on the Corsair, but he hadn't anticipated how far things would go. Yet, reflecting on the affair, he was grateful for new insights into the spirit of the times and his particular mission.
It is true that rabble barbarism has grown to be a much more serious matter than I anticipated at the time. Even though I considered seriously the step I took and was religiously resolved, that is, I have discovered the baseness and demoralization to be far greater than I had imagined it to be. But for that very reason, I must say that it was good that I got involved. For the more earnest the affair grows, the greater is my obligation and my call.
What exactly is this obligation and call? How does the battle with the Corsair help fulfill it? Having concluded his pseudonymous battles with the Romanticists and Hegelians, Kierkegaard now was ready to take on the secular social order that passed itself off as Christian. The common people had been vicious to him, and the cultural elite watched the fray in a cowardly, perhaps secretly satisfied silence. To Kierkegaard, this was eloquent testimony to the real character of Danish Christendom. Kierkegaard saw his martyrdom at the hands of the Corsair as a golden opportunity to change persona, to alter the image he presented to the reading public. Throughout the pseudonymous writings, he'd played the part of a frivolous man about town. He'd attributed his works to fictitious authors, ensuring that their impact owed nothing to his personal authority. Each reader had been forced to decide for himself what was true and what was valuable in them. These practices had perfectly fit Kierkegaard's theory of indirect communication. But now he felt called to challenge the established order directly, to speak against Christendom in his own name without subterfuge. But how could he do this without abandoning his theory of indirect communication? He would become an outcast, a pariah, an object of derision. No one would accept his assertions because he made them, but only in spite of his making them. Kierkegaard spells out this view in a journal entry of March 1846, just 3 months after the battle with the Corsair had begun.
The concluding postscript is out. The pseudonymity has been acknowledged. Everything is in order. All I have to do now is to keep calm, be silent, depending on the Corsair to support the whole enterprise negatively, just as I wish. In itself, it was a most capital idea to make a break with the Corsair in order to prevent any direct advances at the very moment I was through with the authorship and, by assuming all the pseudonyms, ran the risk of becoming an authority of sorts. This is why, right now, when I am advancing polemically against the age, I owe it to the idea and to irony to prevent any confusion with the ironical bad brandy the Corsair serves in the dance halls of contemptibleness.
Kierkegaard's second and explicitly Christian writing is sharply partisan. It reads like a polemic. But we shouldn't view him as a man overwhelmed with bitterness at his public mistreatment. On the contrary, he spent many of the worst months of the Corsair's attack writing a book, Works of Love. This book, his greatest contribution to Christian ethics, reminds us, in earnest yet beautiful prose, that love and love alone is the fulfillment of the law. Kierkegaard's critics say he's excessively individualistic. They think he ignores or even disparages the social dimension of human existence. The Jewish philosopher Martin Buber traces this fault directly to Kierkegaard's concept of the believer's relation to God.
According to Kierkegaard, the relation to God is an exclusive one, the exclusive one. And this means that it is the excluding relation, excluding all others. More precisely, that it is the relation which, in virtue of its unique essential life, drives all other relations into the realm of the inessential.
We could easily understand that a solitary and derided figure might naturally err in saying that the relationship with God excludes others. But Works of Love shows Buber's criticism to be off target. Here Kierkegaard is profoundly alert to both the possibilities and the pitfalls of human relationship. He persistently emphasizes the distinctive character of Christian love. He contrasts Christian love with friendship and erotic love, the natural human manifestations of fellow feeling.
The object, both of erotic love and friendship, has therefore also the favorite's name, the beloved, the friend, who is loved in distinction from the rest of the world. On the other hand, the Christian teaching is to love one's neighbor, to love all mankind, all men, even enemies, and not to make exceptions, neither in favoritism nor in aversion.
In natural human love, two people are attracted to each other because of some excellence or similarity they see in one another. But neighbor love accepts and cares for the other person as he or she is, no matter how unlovely or degraded or even hostile that may be. But how are we to love the unlovely? According to Kierkegaard, neighbor love is possible only because it's commanded.
You shall love is the very mark of Christian love, and its distinguishing characteristic is this: that it contains the apparent contradiction. To love is duty. You shall love. This, then, is the word of the royal law.
Kierkegaard notes that saying we have a duty to love others is an apparent contradiction. How can an emotional state, a quality of heart, be a matter of duty? Earlier, we saw that Judge William describes duty as a divine nourishment for love. But there the love of a spouse was being discussed. There the task was to sustain an existing love that's based on preference and inclination. But in Works of Love, Kierkegaard says the object of preferential love is not really an other. It is instead another I.
that passionate preference is another form of self-love will now be shown, together with its opposite, that self-renunciation's love loves one's neighbor, whom one shall love. Just as self-love centers exclusively about this self, whereby it is self-love, just so does erotic love's passionate preference center around the one and only beloved, and friendship's passionate preference around the friend. The beloved and the friend are therefore called, remarkably and significantly enough, the other self, the other I, for one's neighbor is the other you.
Love of the spouse or friend is still a love of self. It excludes those who are different and unappealing. But neighbor love, a love free of selfishness and differentiation, is a genuine love of another. Where does it come from? Kierkegaard says God himself is the secret hidden source of the very love he commands.
The hidden life of love is in the most inward depths, unfathomable, and still has an unfathomable relationship with the whole existence. As the quiet lake is fed deep down by the flow of hidden springs which no eye sees, so a human being's love is grounded still more deeply in God's love. If there were no spring at the bottom, if God were not love, then there would be neither a little lake nor a man's love. As the still waters begin obscurely in the deep spring, so a man's love mysteriously begins in God's love.
As strange as it may seem, Kierkegaard's harsh and occasionally shrill attacks on church and society are responses to the divinely commanded and provided love. Had he loved less, Kierkegaard surely would have succumbed to the temptation to laugh ironically at human foibles. As it was, he faced what he regarded as the greatest test of love, the need to appear unloving, so he could help the beloved in the way that's needed.
The inwardness of Christian love must not require any reward. The purely human conception of love also teaches that love requires not reward. It only wants to be loved, as if this were not reward. Men will sacrifice this or that and everything, but they still hope to be understood, and thereby to remain in a meaningful human context, in which one's sacrifices are recognized and rejoiced over. But the inwardness of Christian love is willing to be hated by the beloved as reward for its love.
This is the end of Part 7. Please download Part 8 to continue.